Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editor Room Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service of public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on current events when we come back. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 40% of what you create and produce. The government gets the other 60%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes, just like you did this year, and you'll net about 25%, and the government will net 75%. Isn't that even more special? That means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, or 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year, guaranteed by Congress and the IRS, of course. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners, and then only net 25% of it. Why don't you call today and order our free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's a four-hour, entertaining, informational short story on the law school that answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we're paying so much and receiving so little. And let me teach you how to do just that in our Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. Now, to order that free general law CD package, just call us direct and ask for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email when you get to the website and send us an email asking for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. You know, as we are watching the news from day to day and time to time, we see what comes over the news in the form of propaganda. I rail against the propaganda that I hear from the politically correct news establishment, you know, Katie Bryan and Jim Lehrer. Once in a while, though, in the news media, you get a good editorial, and George Will wrote one the other day. It's published in Newsweek magazine. George Will is a conservative editorial writer talking about prohibition. Prohibition 2, he said. Good grief. Perhaps Prohibition 2 is being launched because Prohibition 1 worked so well at getting rid of gin. Or maybe the point is to reassure social conservatives that Republicans remain resolved to purify Americans' behavior. Incorrigible cynics will say that Prohibition 2 is being undertaken because someone stands to make money from interfering with other people making money. Well, for whatever reason, last Friday the president signed into law Prohibition number 2. You almost have to admire the government's plucky refusal to heed history's warnings about the probable futility of this adventure. This time, the government is prohibiting internet gambling by making it illegal for banks or credit card companies to process payments to online gambling operations on a list the government will prepare. Well, last year, about 12 million Americans wagered about $6 billion online. But after Congress, 32 minutes before adjourning, passed its ban, the stock of the largest online gambling business, called Gibraltar-based Party Gaming, which gets 85% of its $1 billion a year annual revenue from Americans, their stock declined 58% in one day, wiping out about $5 billion in market value. Now, the stock of a British company called World Gaming PLC, which gets about 95% of its revenue from Americans, plunged 88%. The industry, which has some 2,300 websites and did half of its business last year with Americans, has lost about $8 billion in market value because of this new law. And you thought the 109th Congress did not accomplish anything. Well, you were wrong. Now, supporters of this new law say that it merely strengthens law enforcement. They claim that internet gambling is illegal under the Wire Act, enabled in 1961 before Al Gore, who was then 13, had invented the internet. But not all courts agree. Supporters of the new law say that online gambling sends billions of dollars overseas, but the way to keep the money here is to decriminalize the activity. The number of online American gamblers, although just one-sixth the number of Americans who visit the real casinos annually, doubled, though, in the last year. Now, this competition alarms the nation's biggest gambling interests, and that is the state governments. That's right, the state governments who operate the biggest gambling operation of all, called the state lotteries. It is an iron law. When government uses laws, tariffs, and regulations to restrict the choices of Americans, ostensibly for their own good, someone is going to make money from the paternalism. One of the big winners from the government's action against online gambling will be the state governments that are America's most relentless promoters of gambling. 48 states, all of the states except Hawaii and Utah, have some form of legalized gambling. It's not government trying to protect you from gambling. It's government protecting you from not gambling in the state's casinos. 42 states have lottery monopolies. 34 states rake in part of the take from casino gambling, slot machines, or video poker. This new law actually legalizes online betting on horse racing, internet state lotteries, and some fantasy sports. The horse racing industry is a powerful interest. The solidarity of the political class prevents the federal officials from interfering with state officials' lucrative gambling. And woe unto the politicians who get between a sports fan and his fun. Now, in the private sector, where realism prevails, casino operators are not hot for criminalizing internet gambling. This is so for two reasons. It's not in their best interest for government to wax censorious, and online gambling might whet the appetites of millions for the real casino experience. Granted, some people gamble too much, and some people eat too many cheeseburgers. But who wants to live in a society that protects the weak-willed by criminalizing cheeseburgers? And besides the problems frequently exaggerated of criminal involvement in gambling and of underage and addictive gamblers can be best dealt with by legalization and regulation utilizing new software solutions. Furthermore, taxation of online poker and other gambling could generate billions for governments. Prohibition number one was a porous wall between Americans and their martinis, giving rise to bad gin supplied by bad people. Prohibition 2 will provoke imaginative evasions as the marketplace supplies what gamblers will demand, and that is a new system of payment methods which are beyond the reach of Congress. But governments and sundry busybodies seem affronted by the Internet as they are by any unregulated sphere of life. The speech that police are itching to bring bloggers under campaign finance laws that control the quantity, the content, and the timing of political discourse. And now, by banning a particular behavior, the entertainment some people choose using their own money, government has advanced its mother hen agenda of putting the saddle and bridle on the Internet. Gambling is, however, as American as the gold rush, or, for that matter, Wall Street. George Washington deplored the rampant gambling at Valley Forge, but lotteries helped fund his army, as well as Harvard, Princeton, and Dartmouth. And George Washington endorsed the lottery that helped fund construction of the city that now bears his name, Washington, D.C., and from which has come a stern but interestingly selective disapproval of gambling. That's an editorial by George Will. I might add my own editorial comments because it deals with a thing called free speech. Free speech, it's probably deplorable to most. It's called hate speech among Jews. Among blacks, they don't like free speech either. You know, free speech in America has been under attack like the Ten Commandments and God himself. Let's take a look at this Imus affair. I couldn't help but chuckle a little bit as this fellow, Don Imus, who's on the air nationwide on CBS, has a syndicated talk show similar to Rush Limbaugh. Anyway, the Don Imus thing over here hit the news the other day because Imus had made a racial statement. And I thought about that for a moment, and I said to myself, you know, that sounds like free speech to me. It may be repugnant to you, and maybe you didn't like what he said. I thought it was inappropriate, to say the least. But whether it's inappropriate or not, if you shut up everybody who says something that you don't like, or if you regulate and control everything or anything that somebody else does that you don't approve of, you create not only the nanny state, but you create a dictatorship. Listen to this. You know, the unprecedented, nasty, and almost gleeful participation of liberal groups in the suppression of a free media by getting Don Imus fired twice in the same week is another warning for our country. What it means simply is that when you go to the polls, you only get to choose who's going to be censoring things for you. Beyond that, you apparently have very few powerful friends in either political party who are going to stand up for free speech. Now, this is a story from Sam Smith from the Under News, dated April the 13th, 2007. It's called The Flip Side of Prejudice. The flip side of prejudice is censorship. It's not the first warning. The Democrats' participation in getting the egregious Patriot Act passed was a major watershed. The refusal of Democratic presidential candidates to take part in a debate sponsored by a major, albeit conservative, TV network was a lesser, but still significant marker. It's all part of America's new bunker mentality. Either you're with us or you're against us. It's a battle that cannot be won, and it's just what the Karl Roves of this world in our country want. Minutes after the CBS firing of Imus, Eleanor Smeal of the Feminist Majority Foundation sent out an email bragging, "Congratulations, we did it." Minutes ago, CBS Radio fired Don Imus. Now, both CBS Radio and MSNBC have finally gotten the message. Women and African Americans have had it with hate speech. But Don Imus isn't alone. We must keep the pressure on to ensure that radio and television airwaves stay free of ugly hate speech. Unquote. And who will get to be the judge of what is acceptable behavior? Eleanor Smeal, for example, may prove to be somewhat selective in which woman she plans to help. After all, she said that Paula Jones' case, which ended in Clinton paying $850,000 in a settlement and losing his law license for 5 years, was a put-up job by the right. She also couldn't be less interested in the rape charges against Clinton by Juanita Broderick. Now, that's one of the problems with censorship. Whether by a right-wing government or by a liberal pressure group, the question arises, well, who gets to decide? The Clintons, for example, considered criticism of themselves to be hate speech. Jews, when they're criticized, consider that to be hate speech. Anybody who is being criticized would call that hate speech. But where does free speech come in? Would Eleanor Smeal include it as well? And who would help her make these choices? Al Sharpton, who once referred to Hasidic Jews as diamond merchants. You know, if you're going to have free speech, you're going to have a lot of people saying things that are stupid and cruel and that you don't agree with. You're going to have people saying some things about you that are mildly outrageous and others that make you want to barf. But there's no way that anyone has discovered yet to protect the free speech necessary for a working democracy without this liability. Any attempt to clean up the place to make everyone nice and civil inevitably starts the ball rolling towards oppression and censorship and suppression of opposition speech. Remember Oliver Wendell Holmes, the famous dictum that he said, "You cannot falsely cry fire in a crowded theater." Well, here's what you probably weren't taught. What the accused, Charles Schenck, had actually done was to leaflet against World War I and the draft. That was the issue, not crying fire in a crowded theater. The issue was a man who was passing out leaflets against World War I and against the draft. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, in his ruling, said, "The question in every case is whether the words used are used in such circumstances and are of such a nature as to create a clear and present danger that they will bring about the substantive evils." In other words, not unlike the arguments used against Imus and his one-liner. In fact, the Imus show was one of the few spots on radio and television where you could hear discussions of public merit that were not canned, were not concocted, were not corporatized, and were not corrupted. This is why so many of the really intelligent people like Craig Crawford or Doris Kearns Goodwin appeared on the Imus show. It was a place to escape the dreary cliches of the Lair News Hour or Meet the Press. And it was also one of the few places on the air where red and blue America came together. It wasn't integrated by sex and gender, but it was by ideology and class, the latter being the last safe haven for socially sanctioned segregation. Liberals will not admit it, but many really don't like white guys without a college degree. And all you have to do is to look at the election results to realize that white guys without a college degree realized this and returned the favor. Don Imus cut across boundaries white liberals don't even want to discuss. The risk now, of course, was that you might hear something that's very unpleasant or very ugly, much as you might also hear at your local bar or on any of the top-selling rap albums that you buy today. In fact, minutes after news that MSNBC had fired Imus, I was walking down our local commercial street and I heard a black guy tell a friend, "That nigga wasn't there." And I thought to myself, you're lucky that you're not on national television or you would be censured. Well, I figure that I can handle it on Channel 38 and on 8th Street Southeast. I'd just as soon it wasn't there, but I don't expect life in America to be made to my specific specifications. And I don't share the liberal presumption that how you say something determines your worth in the world. And I've known too many people who said all of the right things and said them in all of the right ways, like Katie Couric, but then did them wrong. For example, the executives at General Electric, who are currently congratulating themselves for getting rid of that troublesome IMUS at one of their subsidiaries. Here's what else they've also been up to at General Electric. General Electric is making a huge amount of money out of one of the sickest wars in American history. According to the Atlanta Business Chronicle a couple of years ago, despite the inherent risk, rebuilding Iraq is big business. General Electric Energy currently has $600 million in contracts in Iraq, which are paid for by taxpayers in the United States. Murphy said that by 2006, General Electric Energy's parent, General Electric, is expected to have $3 billion in contracts in Iraq. So ask yourself, would you rather be around a well-spoken General Electric war profiteer or an occasionally foul-mouthed TV host who still thinks the truth is worth pursuing? Admittedly, how one reacts to such things depends on various factors. For example, I was the third kid in a family of six, so I have lived with people who disagreed with me all of my life. You can't be a prig for long in such an environment. Once, in explaining to a journalist friend why I didn't hate him for his widely circulated hawkish views on Iraq, I wrote, "I learned to separate the political from the personal when I was 6 years old." I believe in the principle of reciprocity in liberty, which is to say that I can't have my freedom unless you have yours first. Now that means that you and I are both going to be very unhappy with each other from time to time, but it will help both of us remain free. And I have always preferred sinners who try harder over sanctimonious button wearers who are never around when you really need them. The latter group, the button wearers, is overrepresented in a contemporary liberalism that lives off of the victories of yesteryear without much sense of what to do now. Getting mad at IMUS is just one more substitute for actually doing something. Change doesn't come from the stultified, self-righteous corners of America or from the Lair NewsHour or Katie Couric or Brian Williams. It comes where things are a little unsettled, where things are unpredictable, where things are erratic. The IMUS show was one of those places, and you could tell from the sort of people who showed up there, people who were country singers, conservative politicians, intellectuals, liberal journalists. If you were a prescripted politician, you wouldn't want to go near the IMUS show. But if you knew what you thought, and if you knew how to say it, and if you weren't afraid of surprises, the IMUS show wasn't a bad way to get started in the morning for either you or for Don IMUS or for the IMUS listeners. Its problems could have been handled easily. A zapper to eliminate IMUS's fall from grace, just like Jon Stewart uses, would have completely avoided the current furor. Adding a black, maybe even a woman, to the cast would have helped keep IMUS under control and would have made the program even more interesting. MSNBC, CBS, and the liberal groups could have used it as a case study in how to move from hostility to community. Instead, they took the easy way out and in so doing increased the hostility of many of the nearly 4 million listeners to the IMUS program. The truth of the matter is that these corporations and groups, and people like Eleanor Smeal and Al Sharpton, really have very little idea as to how to deal with these kinds of problems. They only know about power, so that when someone does something wrong, then the solution is to beat them down, fire them, shut them up. Well, it hasn't worked in Iraq, and it hasn't worked in the war on drugs, and I don't think that it's going to work in intellectual relations either. The assumption that you can beat somebody into goodness is a leading cause of child abuse, and it's a major reason that we don't get along with each other any better in our society. Here's an alternative approach that I wrote about some years ago. Janet Hampton, a George Washington University professor whose research specifically is Afro-Hispanic studies, grew up black in Kansas. She exudes a cheerful calm, suggestive of having lived around a lot of love. So you might not suspect that she has taught ethnic relations to cops at the local police academy, as well as having been on the faculty of both mostly white and mostly black universities. Here's how she handles the first day of class. She said, I ask the students to tell a little about themselves, and if someone is from a cultural enclave, I tell them about other students from their school or place who have really done well. She pays particular attention to those who come from pariah nations like Iraq. And she told a student from Eritrea that he could be very helpful when the class discussed the American Civil War. I asked her about ethnic slurs. Let's say, Jan said, that a black student uses the word wetback. I would make him apologize, but I would also say that we don't want to lose his point or his point of view. Corrected, but his view is still valued. Janet informs her students that as long as you're never disrespectful, you can say anything you want. We will change by just being together. What Imus and his audience have been told is that not only are they wrong, but there are not to be any values applied to them either. In what possible way does that improve cultural relations in our country? This isn't remediation. It is merely the flip side of prejudice. We've exchanged one prejudice for another. Paul Begala gave a gentle yet stunning example of the alternative on the last day that Imus was on the air. Without a hint of sanctimony, Begala engaged in a mini intervention, and he told Imus of some of the rules that he had for himself, like only attack the powerful. After all, you're a populist, he noticed, and this is what populists do. They attack the powerful. Like, don't make fun of something that is immutable, such as race or gender. Begala spoke of being raised Catholic and learning to hate the sin, but not the sinner, a philosophy that is sadly absent in the present controversy. Then Begala illustrated one of the virtues of the show by admitting to some of his difficulties with his former boss, Bill Clinton, even saying that Clinton had lied to him, but that they had reconciled, and it was a conversation you couldn't imagine elsewhere on TV except on the Imus show. And there was something else. I had never liked Begala, but even as he was reaching Imus, he was reaching me in a new way. And this is how people come closer, not by threats and not by punishment or by repression of speech, but by talking and being together. Well, some years back, I addressed the most important fact about prejudice. It's normal. Prejudice is normal. Now, that isn't to say that prejudice is nice, or that prejudice is pretty, or that prejudice is desirable. Only that suspicion, distrust, and distaste for outsiders is a deeply human trait. The anthropologist Ruth Benedict wrote that all primitive tribes agree in recognizing a category of the outsiders, those who are not only outside the provisions of the moral code, which holds within the limits of one's own people, but who are summarily denied a place anywhere in the human scheme. A great number of the tribal names in common use are only their native terms for the human beings, that is, themselves. Outside of that closed group, there are no human beings. Now, many attempts to eradicate racism from our society have been based on the opposite notion, that those who harbor prejudice towards others are abnormal and social deviants. What if, instead, we were to start with the unhappy truth that human beings have always had a hard time dealing with other people outside of their own group, and that such ethnic and sexual antagonism stems not from hate, so much as from cultural narcissism? Then our repertoire of solutions might tilt more towards education and mediation and away from being self-righteous multicultural missionaries converting yahoos in the wilds of the soul. We could turn towards something more akin to what Andrew Young once described as a sense of no-fault justice, and we might begin to consider seriously Martin Luther King's admonition to his colleagues that among their dreams should be that someday their enemies would be their friends. Now, that's an editorial from the Calamity Howler. The Calamity Howler is free. I subscribe not because I agree with A.V. Krebs, but from time to time, even a liberal has a good point that we can all learn from. The Calamity Howler is published weekly, and it comes with another publication called the Agricultural Examiner, I believe it is. And you can subscribe to the Calamity Howler by simply going to avkrebs@comcast.net. It's avkrebs, K-R-E-B-S. That's a dot v dot Krebs. Or one word, it's avkrebs@comcast.net. So when you go to the email, it's avkrebs, all one word, @comcast.net. I suggest a donation of about $30 a year. And that's what I send him. Comes out on the internet, comes free. He's supported by the voluntary donations of his subscribers. So there's George Will, and there's the Calamity Holler. Hey, listen, I got to give you a mid-course reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the internet daily. For more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through our website as well. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate, and that's because most of the authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, or they are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please visit our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about current events. The news that you don't get from Katie and Brian. Well, the Granditch newsletter, published by Peter Granditch, entitled Granditch Letter Special Alert, The Year of the Pig, The March to the Slaughterhouse Continues. He says, I noted in my February 21st, 2007 edition that I was becoming so bearish that I was contemplating shorting the U.S. stock market. I was hoping for one last big rally on the perception that the Federal Reserve would be cutting or already had cut interest rates. Ideally, this would occur as the Dow Jones Industrial Average went through 13,000, while the touts on TV, especially CNBC, took out their party hats, balloons, and their noisemakers. Well, we witnessed how the Don't Worry, Be Happy crowd on Wall Street is prepared to be the Pied Piper to the lost sheep when the Federal Reserve statement was perceived to have changed towards a more accommodating stance. And while this rally can still occur, the number of bearish fundamentals continues to increase, which makes it even harder not to pull the trigger now and short the stock market. Among the numerous bearish factors that greatly concern me, number one is the supreme fiasco. I was certainly far from being alone in writing extensively about this long before it burst onto the scene. I can't help but chuckle, even though millions of Americans are being hit hard, when I hear and see politicians calling for someone's hide for failing in oversight. But I ask, why the laughter? On February the 26th, 2004, the then Fed chairman, Alan Greenspan, said, quote, American consumers might benefit if lenders provided greater mortgage product alternatives to the traditional fixed-rate mortgage, to the degree that households are driven by fears of payment shocks, but willing to manage their own interest rate risks. The traditional fixed rate mortgage may be an expensive method of financing a home, unquote, from Alan Greenspan on February 26, 2004. Hello? Hello? Is anybody there? If the number one man of finance back in 2004 was feeding the flame instead of dousing it, who can fully blame all of the other parties who are now caught up in the mortgage fire? And let's also not forget that while he encouraged more risk back in 2004, he was also the author of the dramatically lower interest rates that made this credit all that much easier. One potential big negative not readily being discussed today is the fact that mortgages found their way into ever more complicated structured instruments on Wall Street and into portfolios around the world. Much of Wall Street's huge mortgage-related business has been built on being the middleman in a chain, originating or buying mortgages, and then pooling those mortgages, the loans, as backing for bonds, which are then sold to investors around the world. At times, these mortgage-backed securities are themselves packaged with other kinds of loans into more complex debt products known as CDOs, collateralized debt obligations. The subprime fiasco that we are witnessing today has impacted this area of the market, and it has impacted it very hard. Issuance has fallen by more than half this year compared to last year. That's a 50% decrease in 1 year. Many investment bankers are now left holding these subprime loans and related securities that they cannot sell, and securities that are still continuing to lose value. To the Pied Pipers and the touts on TV, who have tried hard to make a case that the worst is already behind us, I would like to remind them that the Federal Reserve Governor, Susan Bias, recently said that subprime mortgage market problems could escalate in the years to come. She pointed out that lenders were likely to see an increase in defaults involving borrowers who took out these subprime mortgages with low teaser interest rates, which jumped to higher levels during the lifespan of the loan. What's happening is the front end of this wave of teaser rate loans is now coming into full pricing, she said. So what we are now seeing in this narrow segment is just the beginning. It's not the end of the wave. Now, the housing bubble has burst. That's the second big bearish problem that I see. So don't be fooled by an odd month's worth of statistics. The bubble has burst. The shell game is over, and there is no quick solution. The number of borrowers in the United States falling behind on the riskier types of home mortgage loans continues to grow. Even mid-level loans, now known in the industry as ALTA mortgages, are seeing a very marked increase in defaults. Previous cheap money allowed almost all on the housing ladder. Now, with most unable or unwilling to get on the lower rungs of that ladder, the upper part of the housing ladder has no bottom to support it. To appreciate how all price levels are being impacted, we note that homes in Bergen County, New Jersey, that sell for 4 times the national median average price have now gone into foreclosure. This is the top of the ladder, children, not the bottom. And then there's the debt load that Americans are carrying. America's total debt load has now climbed to $44.5 trillion. That's 331% of gross domestic product. That's twice the level of 30 years ago. So our debt load has doubled over the past 30 years. Now, the last time that this nation carried a debt load this high was called the Great Depression, when the debt load was 250% of the gross domestic product. So first of all, I'm worried about the subprime fiasco, which is exacerbated by the housing bubble that has now burst, which is exacerbated by the debt levels that Americans are carrying. And that's why I'm bearish. But that's not all. Let's talk about corporate America for a minute. Corporate profits have not only peaked, but corporate profits appear to be heading for a prolonged downturn. And global corporate debt, meanwhile, has now hit its highest volume on record in the first 3 months of this year. And then there's the borrowed money problem. The amount of money borrowed from brokerages that do business on the New York Stock Exchange to buy shares rose to a record in February. The last time that it was a record was in June of 2000. Remember, the stock market peak was in March of 2000. And then there are the economic indicators. Numerous economic indicators, including factory orders and capital spending, are pointing to a sharp slowdown that can lead to a recession in the next 12 to 18 months. Don't let the payroll numbers from yesterday fool you. Historically, there's always a lag between economic indicators turning down and the payroll numbers reflecting that by shrinking. And then there's politics. While the politicians tried in vain to put on a good face after last November's elections, yours truly said that one of the biggest problems facing the United States was the Democrats and Republicans becoming the Hatfields versus the McCoys of the 21st century. I think it's now evident that the feud is deep and only getting uglier. And I believe the world sees it as well. And that's one of the reasons for the U.S. dollar, which is continuing to slide. And then there's China. The United States has once again cut off its nose to spite its face by slapping sanctions on Chinese paper imports. It should be no coincidence that when we imposed tariffs of up to 20% on Chinese coated paper in 2002 in retaliation for tariffs by the Chinese on steel imports, the U.S. dollar began a slide of 35% despite the World Trade Organization reversing those levies back in 2002. Now, this latest move by the United States threatens an already slowing U.S. economy, and once again, it gives cause for the Chinese to lessen or to stop their capital inflow into our United States bond market, and we depend upon $2 billion a day plus from these external sources to keep our markets from going bankrupt. Bottom line, the last hurrah in the U.S. stock market is now nearing its end. And I'm going to still hope for at least one last rally to new all-time highs in conjunction with the Pied Pipers on CNBC TV declaring all is well in the world, and I know they do it every day. I'm just waiting for them to do it with party hats and noisemakers. And then there's the U.S. dollar. You know, once the U.S. stock market puts in the top, I fully expect all of those don't worry, be happy crowd that are on Wall Street to use the continuing slide in the U.S. dollar to convince us that it is a positive for the stock market. How so? Well, they will claim that a cheaper dollar will make U.S. goods cheaper overseas, and that's great for multinational corporations. Don't sweat China. Don't sweat India. Don't worry about Brazil and all of the other growing economies. The U.S. was a great economic power. Now, the only party that doesn't know that the U.S. dollar is dead is the U.S. dollar and the people of the United States of America. It's been my firm belief that 80 on the U.S. dollar index will be tested and eventually broken. And if and when it does, the world will get a sell signal that it has never seen before on the dollar, and the fat lady will have sung, past tense. And there is an important note. Brazil is the latest central bank to publicly announce its plan to diversify its foreign currency reserves. The central bank's monetary policy director said, "The idea is gradually, at a slow pace, to raise part of our reserves in assets that are not linked to the United States dollar." And then there's the oil problem. When we hit $50 a barrel, I felt the worst was over and thought a broad trading range of $50 to $65 would take hold. I still do, but I now realize that we can overshoot $65 for a while on geopolitical and weather concerns, and how fast the world slows down economically versus weather and geopolitical factors is what we call the $64,000 question, and I don't have the answer. Gold is another problem. Other than stepping aside for a couple of significant corrections, I've been an ardent gold bull. In early March, many in the gold camp turned bearish or were looking for a sizable correction. Even the strategist of one of bullion's biggest websites was hedging himself daily. In fact, the Hulbert Digest noted in a March 7th article in MarketWatch that it hit 0% bulls, which means that the average gold timing newsletter had no exposure to the gold market whatsoever. And yours truly stood firm because none of the factors that kept me bullish to that point in time had changed. Sure enough, gold has rallied and is heading for a challenge of last year's highs of $735. Now, readers know the drill by now that the U.S. dollar, the number one bullish factor, is declining. The U.S. dollar is dead, which about 8 out of 10 times leads to a rising gold price. Geopolitical concerns here and abroad are likely to only get worse, bolstering gold as an alternative to the world's reserve currency. Strong and physical investment demand. Gold's rally the last few weeks came in the face of marked increase in central bank selling, proving that this once detrimental factor is no longer a major concern. The International Monetary Fund recently reported that central bank gold holdings fell to the lowest level since 1948. Manipulations by the gold cartel. I see another so-called gold expert has dragged GATA through the sarcasm mud that non-believers of manipulation seemingly like to do versus openly debate the GATA with facts. And while I openly declare I don't agree with my friend Bill Murphy to the extent of the manipulation on a daily or hourly basis, Bill and GATA have gone so much further in substantiating their side of the argument that the non-believers, and quite frankly, the non-believer argument of no possible manipulation is a non-starter to begin with. So our markets are being tampered with by the plunge protection team. Free markets in America are dead. So let's face reality. Then there's silver and copper and the other base metals. There's inflation, and then there's uranium. And when you take a look at all of these factors and you put them together, it tells us a story, boys and girls, that inflation is bad. Inflation is getting worse. We've about reached the top of the stock market. We are in recession. We have been in recession for 18 months. The government statistics are lies. They have been lying to us and deceiving us. And now, some of the more moderate financial writers, like Peter Brandich, are wising up and writing it to their subscribers. So I thought I would report that to you and share with you that everything that you hear by Katie and Brian and on the Lair News Hour isn't necessarily true, accurate, or correct. Our government has been lying to us. They are lying to us, and they will continue to lie to us to keep us in the dark concerning the true state of the national and world economies. The smart money is moving out of dollars and into gold and silver. The smart money is moving out of dollars and into commodities, whether it's uranium or copper or zinc or anything but United States dollars. And so it goes. Well, we're about out of time, boys and girls. I'm going to have to cut it off right there and remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.